touch with me and come and volunteer. We have a lot of fun putting together events like today's. We've been doing this for almost a year and a half now. We've had some great talks and some great events, which I'm sure many of you have come to. I'd like to, again, welcome Professor Richard Kestner. He received his PhD from the University of Rochester in 1986, and he's been at McGill for 21 years, which is a pretty impressive long time. And I knew Richard when he first joined McGill, so that makes me feel... Richard has published over 100 articles in peer-reviewed journals on human motivation and personality. His recent work focuses on how to effectively set and pursue personal goals, and that's the topic of his talk today. Richard is a great teacher. He received the 2007 Canadian Psychological Association Award for Teaching. He received the McGill Full Professor Principal's Prize in Teaching in 2008. He is hugely popular with our students, and his courses are popular. And in fact, in an article in the Tribune last semester, he was named one of the profs that you want to run into on campus, and it was a very charming article. If any of you read it, so the talk today is about New Year's resolutions, why we fail at them, and research on effective goal setting. And I'll just turn over to Francisco. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Robin. I really appreciate that. And I am a motivation researcher. And when I meet people on the golf course or in a social setting and I tell them that I'm a motivation researcher, I get one of two responses. The first response is, I need some of that. The other response I get is, my son needs some of that. I've never had a single person say, my daughter needs some of that. And what people usually mean, I think, is that they need more drive, more energy, more direction. And that if they could just get more drive and direction, they'd be able to accomplish a little bit more, maybe be a little healthier, be a little happier. And today I want to talk about the way I think most of us do try to add motivation to our lives. And I think we do it usually by setting a goal. And because it's January, I think it's very appropriate to talk about one kind of goal setting that's quite common, and that is to make a New Year's resolution. A New Year's resolution is basically a goal, only it's an important goal. It's a very serious goal. About half the people in North America make New Year's resolutions, not necessarily every year, but every other year, let's say. And there's kind of consistency to the resolutions that people make. The most common always is to quit smoking. The next most common is to lose weight. The third on the list is to start exercising. This year, something has happened, which only happens every 10 years or so, which is suddenly making a personal budget has become a very popular resolution, particularly in the United States. In bad economic times, this arises. Now, I'm interested in New Year's resolutions because I'm a guy who's always set New Year's resolutions. And here's some examples of resolutions that I failed at. I still haven't succeeded. I used to be very discouraged by the fact that I fail at my resolutions. But by doing research in this area, I learned that failure is the norm. People succeed at a New Year's resolution only after failing 6 or 7 times. That's the average. So my resolutions have always been to watch less TV. You know, I like TV, but as a professor, it's kind of embarrassing to be watching Seinfeld reruns when I could be writing or reading or doing something. Coming to Montreal as an American from New York City, I quickly made the resolution to learn French. I've made that resolution over and over and over and over. I had a sabbatical last year, and that was the focus of my sabbatical. As a professor, I have found that I feel best about myself and my work when I'm in a writing mode, when I'm writing every day. But sometimes I lapse into not writing, so I always make resolutions about being consistent in writing. I was raised a Catholic. I feel very guilty when I don't go to church, so I always make resolutions about going to church, too. So I haven't failed at all my resolutions. I've actually succeeded at a couple. And my guess is that most of you, if you make resolutions or if you set goals each year or if you set goals each semester, you probably have the same experience as I do, where most of the time you have a sense of not succeeding and of failing, but every now and then you do succeed. So naturally it's interesting to ask, well, why did I succeed at that one but not this one? So today I'll be trying to talk to you about some standard ideas about how to set goals, and then I'll also talk to you about some more recent research that I think goes beyond the standard suggestions. Okay. There was a classic study done back in 1990 in the city of Scranton, Pennsylvania, where they recruited a large number of adults after Christmas and before New Year's, and they said, you know, if you're thinking about making a resolution, please join our study, come into our lab, tell us what you're proposing. And then they systematically followed up this large sample for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and so on. And I'm not going to tell you much about the study. I just want to show you the failure rates, the point at which people are saying, you know, I'm not following this anymore. If you look at this, what I find particularly amazing is that after a week, almost one quarter of the New Year's resolvers have said they failed. I wouldn't think they even had a chance to start yet, but they've decided that they failed. After 1 month, about 50% have failed. So failure happens very quickly, and I think it's because people are trying to break habits and start new habits, and it just doesn't engage right away. If people do make it for the first month, then the failure rate slows down a bit. But this particular study only went to 6 months, but there's other studies that have gone to a year. The estimate is about 80% of people will have failed after a year, and most people guess that this is just based on self-report information, so it might be a little bit inflated. So in fact, 90% of people probably fail. Now, why should we care about goal progress with something like New Year's resolutions or other goals that you have? The first thing I would say is many of the resolutions are actually very important. And there's evidence that people who do quit smoking, people who do lose weight, they do it by setting a goal themselves and pursuing their own goal. It's much more likely that people will change their health behaviors by setting their own goals than actually being involved in some kind of treatment. Although, of course, that's often helpful too. But most people who make changes do so in a self-initiated way. The other thing that's very clear is that all of us feel better about ourselves when we are making progress on our goals. One of the paths to well-being is to have a sense of making progress on the important goals in your life. Now, right away, this presents a predicament. I'm telling you that 90% of us are going to fail at our New Year's resolutions. I'm telling you that if we succeed, we feel good, but obviously if we fail, we feel bad. So right away, there's a question of, is this a worthwhile enterprise? And some motivation researchers will tell you it's a false hope syndrome. You should not get involved in New Year's resolutions. You're going to end up disappointing yourself. Myself and others would say that, no, most of us learn from each attempt, and the next time we try, we often do a better job of it. And it's only by repeated attempts that we can usually succeed at our really important, difficult goals. Okay. Why do we fail? I'm going to briefly present a model of self-control, success, and failure, and then I'll show you some examples of New Year's resolutions that students here at McGill have provided over the years, and then I'll tell you about some other research that myself and colleagues have done in this area. This model of self-control would suggest that there are three critical ingredients that we require if we're going to self-regulate effectively, if we're going to pursue our goals in a persistent, resilient manner. The first important ingredient is that we need standards, or we need clear goals. if our standards or goals are ambiguous or if they're in conflict with each other, it will be very hard to exercise self-control in relation to them. When I show you examples of the way people actually set their New Year's resolutions, the one thing that will jump out at you is that they're always very ambiguous and non-specific. So the way we frame our goals is important. Okay, so assuming you have a clear, specific goal and you framed it very nicely, the second critical ingredient is to monitor your behavior in relation to the goal. It's not enough just to have the goal. You have to be attentive to whether you're pursuing the goal and whether you're having the results that you expect. My sister-in-law last year, she's a librarian in Ottawa, she said her goal, her New Year's resolution was going to be to get to work on time. And she had had this resolution before and she hadn't succeeded, but she said this year she was going to succeed because she was really going to write down each day whether she got there on time or not. So I happened to see her a week later and I said, how's it going? And she says, disaster. I've been late 4 times out of 5 days. And I said, well, what have you learned from monitoring? And she said, well, it should only take 30 minutes to get there, but there's always something that goes wrong. The bus is a little late, something happens to the elevator. And what she realized was that the time she was waking up, the time she was getting it, she was just off by about 10 or 15 minutes. So she had to make those adjustments. So we need standards, we need monitoring, and then there's a third ingredient. Let's say you have a perfectly clear, specific goal, you're monitoring the way you ideally can. The final ingredient, which I think is the most important, and you'll see why I say this later on, is you need some self-control strength or resources. You need some capacity to actually get yourself to act on the goals that you've set for yourself. And what this capacity involves is altering or overriding your typical way of responding and substituting some more desirable way. The tricky thing about self-control strength is that there's very good evidence that this is a limited resource for all of us. We only have a finite amount of it. And they've done some very compelling experiments where they show that if you use your self-control, let's say to resist temptation or to suppress your emotions, and then you're given another task that requires persistence or concentration, you will perform very poorly at the second task because your self-control resources have been depleted by the first activity. And the suggestion would be that in all of our lives, we're exercising a lot of self-control, a lot of willpower to do the things we need to do, and that if we add a new goal or a new plan, it may be difficult to find the extra bit of self-control that we need to really stick with that. Now, I have a visual demonstration of this, and I, you're an older group than I use. I mean that in a positive way. You're an older group than I usually talk to, so I think you'll relate to this. But here's a visual depiction. This is myself in the year 2000 with my wife. I am at my self-regulatory best here, so that by my standards, I'm presenting myself as well as I can. I have a nice shirt on. I've combed my hair. My eyeglasses are on straight. I have good color in my face, good emotion. Here I am 2 years later, exactly the same day. My glasses are on crooked. My hair hasn't been combed. I'm wearing sweatpants. I probably haven't brushed my teeth. I haven't flossed my teeth. I haven't shaved. The only thing that changed from the first picture to the second picture is that I had my daughter. And it's, you know, the greatest thing in my life was having my daughter. But something that I was surprised to see happen is that I started slipping all over the place. Things I took for granted, like brushing teeth, taking showers, putting my clothes on in an effective way. Things I had taken for granted, I started slipping. And my daughter was sleeping okay. It wasn't lack of sleep. I think the challenge for me was I wanted to be a helpful, involved father. And there's just so much to think about, and I had to change my habits so dramatically that I was expending all of my self-control resources trying to adapt to the role of father, and I saw slippage across the board. So I would suggest that there is something to this, that we do have a limited amount of self-control resources, and what that probably means is we have to be thinking about that when we set goals. Here's some examples from students. I collected these about 20 years ago when I first came. I teach motivation in January. I thought, you know, might as well ask the students what their resolutions are. And then I followed up at 2 months and asked them, to what extent have you been succeeding on your two most important ones? And the success rates are in the parentheses. I've changed the name, but here's a student named Teresa. She sets resolutions the way I always did. She seems like an optimistic kind of person. College student in January, her resolutions are to do volunteer work, to keep up with schoolwork, to be a nicer person, to write home more often, and to read more good books. Can you see any problem with this collection of New Year's resolutions? There's way too many, and they'll be working against each other. How can she be keeping up with schoolwork while also doing volunteer work and writing home and reading more good books? It's just not enough self-control resources to be doing all of those things at the same time. And there's no specificity about any of these goals that she's listed either. Keep up with schoolwork. What exactly does that mean? Reviewing your notes earlier, making sure you go to class. And this is common. The lack of specificity is very common, and also the lack of consistency between the different goals. Here's my all-time favorite, another student. She said her goal is to do really well this semester. Her second goal is to get over my ex-boyfriend once and for all. And her third goal, which fits with the second one, is to not be so neurotic. Very colorful collection of goals. And I've always liked that one. But there's a problem with specificity here. Like, what does it mean to get over your ex-boyfriend once and for all? Does it mean that you shouldn't be talking to your friends about him all the time? Does it mean you shouldn't be circling his block every evening? I mean, you have to define specifically what that would be. Here's a third example. This fellow I call Ziggy. And I'm just going to read his first one. His first goal is to attempt to keep up with reading. He wrote that. We didn't write that. And I would suggest that just by the way the fellow is writing it, he's kind of conceding that he's not likely to succeed at this. And there is a suggestion that you need a certain level of confidence in your ability to pursue a goal if you're going to set it, and that seems to be lacking. So now I'm going to tell you the standard spiel that Dr. Phil would tell you, that any organizational and sports psychologist would tell you, which is that you have to set SMART goals. And by SMART goals, they're referring to an acronym that characterizes the way goals should be framed. So goals should be specific, not ambiguous, and goals should be measurable. Goals should be achievable. What they mean by that, it's something under your control. So you might, for example, have a goal to get along better with your mom or dad, but if your mom or dad is a really cantankerous, difficult individual, it may not be fully under your control. So achievable has to do with whether it's under your control. Fourth characteristic, a goal should be realistic. This has to do with the level of challenge. You don't want a goal that's too easy. It won't inspire you. It won't give you any powerful motivation. And you don't want a goal that's too difficult. You want something optimally challenging. And finally, we need to time frame our goals. So if you have a really long-term goal, it's too far in the future to really help guide your behavior. So it would be helpful to insert shorter-term goals until you get to that long-term goal. So specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, time frame. This is what most psychologists would tell you. They would rub their hands, take some questions, and they would say, okay, you could go now. My own feeling is that this is not sufficient. I mean, research suggests that it does help to follow these principles of framing your goals. But what this has failed to do to some extent is acknowledge the fact that our self-control resources are limited, and that when we set a goal, we have to really think about that limitation. So I'll give you an example of another student who set a perfect pair of New Year's resolutions or goals, so that her goal was to drink 8 glasses of water a day, exercise 3 or 4 times per week. You notice how specific it is in terms of how much water and how many times of exercising. The two types of goals could kind of work together. You could imagine her drinking water while exercising. So really nice pair. There's only 2. There's not too many. But her success was 10% with the first goal, 40% with the second goal, so that she still failed at reaching these goals. And my guess is that many of us, even if we frame it as perfectly as we can, we still have to do more. And so the rest of the talk, I'll highlight what else I think we need to do. I think right at the start, we have to anticipate that self-control is going to be a problem. And we have to think about whether we can overcome the self-control limitations that we all suffer from. And is there a way to work around it or to bypass the limitations? And I'll suggest that there are 2 things, and the research I do supports this. There are 2 things that we can do. One is we can be careful about the goals we select. There are certain kinds of goals, if they really connect with our interests and our values, it's more natural and spontaneous to pursue them. And we don't have to draw upon as much self-control resources. So the first thing I'll say is how we select the goals is important, or which goals we select. And secondly, I'll suggest that after we've selected the goal, we have to do a little bit more planning and thinking about exactly where, when, and how we're going to pursue that goal. And we have to come up with a plan that makes goal pursuit kind of automatic. So the first thing, goal selection. My own research in many different areas, I focus on the concept of autonomy. And with respect to goals, it refers to the extent to which a goal reflects your developing interests and your core values versus something you feel compelled to do by external or internal pressures. The key issue here is, does the goal really come from you? Or is it something you're doing because you feel you should do it or that others are doing it? And there's a lot of evidence in the field of motivation that goals that really connect with your interests and your abiding personal values are the ones that will be most easy to follow and to persist with. So how do we measure that? We will ask individuals what their goals are, and then we ask, to what extent is your motivation this, that, or the other thing? And so, for example, trying to learn French. Richard, why are you trying to learn French? Is it because I really believe it's an important goal to have? Is it because of the fun and enjoyment the goal offers? These are more autonomous reasons. And with something like learning a language, you could see where some people would say, yeah, it's cool to learn a new language. It would be really interesting. And yes, it's very important in my everyday life. These are more autonomous reasons. Unfortunately, when I came to Quebec, I had a little bit of that kind of motivation, but I also had these kinds of reasons. So why are you trying to learn French? Because I feel guilty. I feel embarrassed. I feel pressured. So because somebody else wants me to, or because I would feel guilty if I didn't, these are things people endorse, and these are more controlled kind of reasons. In one of my early studies, we did something very simple, which is we measured whether people had more autonomous or controlled reasons for their resolutions. We followed them up, and we found that autonomy was significantly related to making better progress. So that the people who had more autonomous reasons, they made about 58% progress after 2 months in this study, whereas the people who had less autonomous only made 40%. Since that time, there's been 16 other studies. It's a very reliable effect. It's significant. And the size of the effect means that if you had a 40% chance, you know, on any given goal, if you have a more autonomous goal, then you have about a 60% chance of reaching it. So when I looked at some of my failed resolutions, I realized some of them, my motivation was more controlled rather than autonomous. I was mostly aware of how I should do this and how I felt guilty about not having accomplished it. And I'll give you another example of this. This is a classic old study where they brought sixth graders and they said, we want you to make New Year's resolutions. So they were forced to write down their resolutions. And some of the things they said were, do my homework on time, don't tease my sister, eat less candy. The last two are my favorites. Be a loyal citizen and help the United States. What I like about these is that the kids are being compelled to do it, and what they're writing sounds like things that their parents or teachers would want them to write. Now, the point I would make is that unfortunately some of the goals we set for ourselves actually sound like things that someone else would set for us. And it's not always clear that we're personally resonating to these goals. So I would suggest that one of the first things we have to do in terms of goal selection is stop and look carefully at the goal and say, you know, why am I pursuing this goal now? Does it connect with my interests and my personal values, or is it something that I feel compelled to do? And something that you can then do, if it is mostly control and compulsion, is to ask yourself, can I make it more autonomous? So with learning French, I've worked at trying to find ways of making it more interesting and fun. And I've also worked very hard at thinking through, well, this is why it would be important, because I have students who speak French. Whenever I get together with my French colleagues, they all have to switch to English, and so it would really be great if I could speak French. But I'll tell you the interesting and fun thing that I've learned to do, and I do this pretty consistently, and it's helped somewhat, is that I have a friend who's a Francophone professor at UChem, and he's learned Spanish with the Pimsleur Spanish language system. He sent away for 90 cassettes. He comes in from the West Island, and he listens to one cassette as he's driving in. And he says it's great. It prompts you. And so after he told me that, I sent away for the Pimsleur 90-tape French language instruction program. And when I drive to work, I listen to the tapes. It prompts you, and then you speak in French. And one of the things that I've really been surprised at is I actually like talking in French, as long as no one else is there to listen to me. And the barrier for me is that my accent and pronunciation is really painful. But this I can do, and I've been working on it, and I can understand spoken French now, and I can read French. I still cannot communicate like I would like, but it was a challenge to try to approach this goal from a more autonomous point of view. Okay, so the first thing I would say is if you find a goal or find a way to make the goal connect with your interests and values, it will be more natural and spontaneous to pursue it. You won't be fighting this willpower battle all the time. But there's a second thing that I think we could do. And I'll first show you with this one. It involves using implementation plans, but I'll tell you a story about how I learned about this. In my seventh year at McGill, I was taking an intensive French class because I felt guilty about not knowing French. And we had to give an expose, a 5-minute talk to the whole class. And because I always talk about New Year's resolutions, I said, okay, I'll talk about New Year's resolutions. And that year, my goal happened to be drinking 8 glasses of water a day. So I gave my talk. I told everyone that I failed again, like I always did. And then the teacher had a pause. And after the pause, a student and another student named Gwen came up to me with a bottle of water. It was a fresh bottle of water. And she said, voilà une solution pour votre problème. And I said, je ne comprends pas. Expliquez, s'il vous plaît. And then she explained that I had a goal intention But I did not have a plan that specified where, when, and how I would be getting this water. And she said what she learned to do, and she knows other people who do it, is that they buy a bottle of water, they fill it up in the morning, and they put it in their backpack, and they keep it at their workstation. And it's a cue and a reminder to get water, and it's always with you. And she said she never has problem drinking water. And after she gave me this little plan about when, where, and how by using this, I haven't had problems. I don't drink eight bottles. That's too much. But I do drink four bottles a day. And the suggestion here is that having a goal intention is really only the first step, and you have to follow it up with some plans about where, when, and how you'll pursue the goal. And the researchers who do this are the German researchers, and they would suggest holding a goal intention does not guarantee goal achievement because people may fail to deal with the self-regulatory problems during goal striving, so that there'll be interference from other things that come up during the day. There'll be unplanned obstacles and distractions. And what they would suggest is that whenever we have a goal intention, we should take 3 to 5 minutes and do a little mental exercise where we specify where, when, and how are we going to pursue this goal. And also, if an obstacle arises, what will we do? Now, I'll give you some examples of this, and then I'll tell you about the research on this. Both the Montreal Gazette and La Presse had articles several years ago about women who finally succeeded at getting in shape and going to the gym and staying fit. And there were all of these stories and quotes, and I was really struck because in almost every case, what I saw was that the individual found an implementation plan that really fit them very well. So here's the first lady. This was from the Gazette. She says, "The fact that I've been so successful in my exercise regimen is thanks to my simple routine. Everything is prepared, packed, and set next to the front door the night before. The workout clothes, the gym bag, the work stuff. The coffee machine is set to brew. Frozen bagels are placed in the oven. Basically, nothing is left to chance. The less I have to think about, the better." This is a very obsessive, compulsive lady. But she has a great plan and one that fits her very well. She's setting it up so that it's automatic every morning for her to go do her fitness. And after she's done it for a couple weeks, it probably becomes a new habit. So she has a really good plan. It's not a plan that would work for all of us, but I think it suits her well. Here's another example from La Presse, and in this case, the lady was a businesswoman. She's working in a business setting, and her implementation plan, which I think would be more relevant to many of you, was she had for a long time wanted to regain her figure. To motivate herself and to stay disciplined, she decided to write her moments of training in her agenda as if it was a meeting at the end of the day, and always at the same time. And then she made herself respect this the way she would around a meeting with a colleague, and it became like an automatisma, and it became a part of her life. So basically, I think what the lady is saying is she runs her life by her agenda, and if she elevates her workouts by putting it in her agenda and always selecting the same time, this is a way to make it part of her routine and to make it automatic. And I would suggest that many of us have an idea that, okay, we're going to exercise today, or we're going to, but we're often overwhelmed by other things that come up. So that the first lady, she makes sure she does it in the morning and everything's set up. This lady makes sure that there's a predictability about it, and that she gives it a respect that she hadn't previously. And both of them were successful. Now, this is what I use in my research, and in our research with college students, we ask them what their goals are for the semester, or goals for the weekend, or for the month. We do it over various time intervals. And after they've told us the goal, we simply say, please think about how you will complete this goal, indicate when, where, and how you'll carry it out. So people have to say the time and the place. And then we ask them to anticipate distractions and obstacles. And what we find is that just doing this additional 3-minute exercise leads to a significant improvement in people's success at following through. And I've only done a bit of this research. A lot of this research has been done in healthcare settings, trying to get people to follow through on recommendations. And there's been 94 independent studies which show that there's quite a strong and robust effect of making these kinds of implementation plans. My own recent research suggests that the two things I've described can be combined, so that if you select goals that connect with your interests and values, and then if you also add implementation plans that specify where and when and that make it automatic to pursue it, that this combination is not merely additive, but it's synergistic, so that the highest levels of goal success that we find is when people have both things, when they know why they're selecting the goal and when they have also thought through how they're going to pursue the goal. So, in summary, I would suggest that for most of us, the way we add motivation to our lives is by setting goals. New Year's resolutions are one example, but you probably set goals every semester, every week, every day. It's only the tricky thing about New Year's resolutions is we actually follow them up so that we know that we're not succeeding. But many of our other goals we don't follow so carefully. But we typically fail at our goals. I tend to think that that's the natural course of events, but that we learn from our failures, and people do feel a little bad, but what you learn may be enough to help you the next time. I think we fail primarily because we have limited self-control. It's very clear that we could deplete our self-control resources. On a day like this, I felt like I depleted my self-control resources just coming into school today. And I've often wondered whether, you know, January in Montreal may not be the ideal time to be making New Year's resolutions, because there's a lot of added worry and thinking and planning you have to do. So I think the evidence is pretty clear that if we select autonomous goals that connect with our interests and values, we make more progress. And, you know, sometimes you can't choose an autonomous goal. Sometimes you're stuck with a goal because it's important to your health or to your work. Then the challenge is, can you make it more autonomous? Can you add value to it? Can you add interest to it? I think there's very good evidence that using implementation plans will help in pursuing goals. However, I would suggest that there's a real art to implementation plans. You have to find ways of developing implementation plans that really fit you. And the key is to make it so that goal pursuit is automatic. So it's kind of a new habit. So that instead of having to use willpower every instance that you pursue this goal, it will kind of unfold more spontaneously. And the final thing I'll say, in case any of you are discouraged about your New Year's resolutions and your lack of success, is that success almost always takes multiple attempts. As I said, 6 or 7 in most cases. That's all I have to say, and thank you very much. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to address them. Yeah.
So if you do have questions, we've got about 15 minutes, and if you can just, before you ask your question, just press the button on the microphone in front of you to turn it on so that it'll be picked up on our webcast. Yes.
Yes.
Is it part of the problem how we define failure, too? I mean,
oh, yes.
If a large number of people have as a goal weight loss, and they say after 6 months, 60% of people have failed, well, they haven't gone through the year yet, so they don't even know if they've lost weight by the end of the year because they haven't given themselves a chance.
I think that's especially true with weight loss. People usually have high expectations, and they just... Often people experience initial success, and they're very excited. But the way the weight loss process works is you kind of hit a point where it gets much harder to lose any more. And then often people break down and gain some weight. But I think you're absolutely right that we often have unrealistic ideas of the level of success we can accomplish and the pace of success. So that for some of us, it's just a matter of adjusting the level of the goal we're striving for. Like the goal that I always had was to learn French, and I realized after a few years that that's too broad of a goal and that I could break that down. So a goal for me became learn to read French. And I don't know if others who have immigrated, that was relatively easy to do, to learn to read in French. And then learn to understand spoken French. I've been able to do that, especially if it's like Radio Canada or something and not... So I did try to define what I mean by learning French in more specific ways. But I think you also point to the other problem quite often is that we can feel very disappointed and we can conclude that we failed perhaps a little bit too quickly. The reverse is true too sometimes. Sometimes you have to decide that this goal doesn't really suit me and it's time to put this goal aside and I should focus on other things. So I could see both of those concerns arising. Thanks. Yeah.
I have a question, and in terms of limited self-control, is there any way to increase? I mean, it's different between different people, so I'm guessing that is this a skill that we can acquire?
Yeah, that's the argument. Is it's like a muscle that it actually can be trained, and it will generalize. And so there's some research going on now which suggests that if you get people who succeed at, for example, going to the gym and doing cardio work and doing some strength training, you'll surprisingly see some gains in some other areas of their life. They'll be better at budgeting or better at something else. So there is a suggestion that it's a limited resource, but it's something that can be built up with training. But I don't think there's very conclusive evidence yet exactly how that can be done or how much of an improvement we can make. But, yeah.
Do we have other questions? Yes.
How do you deal with having too many goals?
Yeah, that's the number one problem for college students, and they often have so many goals at the same time. What I would suggest, what they do with athletes, it turns out athletes are very responsive when a sports psychologist comes in and says, okay, goal setting is what could really help you. But athletes tend to like go to the limit right away, and they want to pursue 12 new goals. So what a sports psychologist has to do is say, no, you have a limited amount of self-control resources, and the way we should do this is let's pursue two goals at first and see how that goes in the first 2 months, and then we'll move on to the other goals. And the other problem they find with athletes is they're always capable of raising their level of goals, but they have a hard time reducing the level. So if they're injured or if they're having a difficult season, they have... So what you say is definitely a concern, that it's a problem if we have too many goals. And, I mean, it reflects kind of an optimistic, achievement-oriented quality, but in terms of mustering the self-control resources to actually follow through on them, it's probably better to stagger them so that, I think for many of us, we would do well to have like one or two New Year's resolutions and then make a resolution July 1st and follow that resolution then, rather than trying to have four resolutions at New Year's. Because it is very hard to find the energy to pursue new goals and new directions.
What about the role of rewarding yourself for achieving your goals?
That's a really tricky one. Many people in the field would recommend that. The problem for me is that most of my early research focused on children and focused on how rewards can undermine intrinsic motivation or autonomous motivation. So I'm always... Self-reward is better, but I'm always suspicious of reward. And I think a better approach is to design to select the goal and to find an implementation plan that makes the process itself rewarding. So something with fitness, a lot of people would suggest doing the fitness activities or making the goal with a friend is something that's very useful because it makes it into a social activity and it adds a rewarding element to it. It also works as an implementation plan because every time you see the friend, you're reminded that you're going to work out. And it makes it easier to become part of your everyday. I mean, I wouldn't say necessarily there's any problem with rewarding yourself when you succeed, but the focus is, I think it's better if the focus is on the actual process of pursuing the goal and making that as rewarding as possible. Yes?
How do you make the distinction between limits on your self-control and addiction?
I'm not sure exactly what you mean, being addicted to some other things that you're doing and you can't... I haven't actually thought about that. I think we are creatures of habit, and perhaps an addiction would be an example of a very powerful habit that interferes with many other realms of our lives. So I would guess that if any of us suffer from an addiction, it would make it even harder to exercise self-control for new goals and new pursuits. But I'm not sure I exactly got the meaning of... Yeah.
It was just, you know, addictions can range anything from, you know, substance abuse and physical need for something in it to just a very bad habit or a very strong habit.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just, where do you draw that line between what is an addiction that needs to be addressed with other means?
Well, this comes up when I teach about this. I'll often have a female student in my class come up and say, I think my boyfriend's addicted to TV. He just can't pull himself away from the TV. And they actually have scales to measure whether you have a psychological dependence on TV. And the key differentiating thing is whether it starts to interfere with your functioning in important aspects of your life. I definitely do think that if people have addictions in their lives, it will make it harder to set goals in other areas. And if it is a true addiction, it will probably be especially difficult to change the behavior in that area as well. But quitting smoking is the most common New Year's resolution. And it's amazing. I mean, it's so difficult to quit smoking. But the statistics on the millions and millions of people who've successfully quit smoking over the last 20 years, it's really quite astonishing. And many people who you might have thought, boy, these people are addicted to smoking. But the results seem to suggest that it takes many attempts and that they learn from the previous attempts. There's also some research, it's not my area, but there's some research now that suggests we start smoking in groups and we quit smoking in groups so that our friendship networks and our family connections, there's an interpersonal connected process that's involved in quitting smoking and actually in losing weight too. That's not something that I focus on in my own research, but some people would point you to look at something like that.
There's many goals that I've tried. Not only do I not end up succeeding, but it becomes worse. Like I'll end up smoking more or I'll end up drinking more for a period of time until I get back to normal the way it was.
That's a reliable phenomenon where, especially if you're trying abstinence and if you restrict yourself, that's kind of overwhelming. And once you break that restriction, there's a tendency to go overboard, to catch back up. So that is common, especially with smoking and eating and some other things. So, but even with that, I think each time people make an attempt, they can ask, okay, I tried this. This is what happened. Is there something else I can do? I would point toward the implementation plans as the area where you could really try different kinds of things. But I do want to acknowledge that even with an autonomous goal and a great implementation plan, it's not the case that you'll be able to succeed right away. It seems like, at best, it takes 3, 4, 5 attempts before we succeed. And this is generally speaking, so some people may not be able to succeed with certain things, even with more attempts. But the rebound that you described is actually very, it's a kind of a reliable phenomenon. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for joining us. Our next event's on February 28th, so watch for our e-bulletins, and we look forward to seeing you for Dr. Vera's talk on the 28th. Thanks for coming out.